Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Well, it's getting a little chillier, so home fires are comfortable at this temperature. I'm really looking forward to this evening. With me in the studio are Nilo Kopanen, homesteader, surveyor, educator, researcher, gardener, builder, and finally, winner of the Volunteer of the Year Award, and last but not least, elected representative in Juneau, and Austin Smith, a contractor and also a homesteader, both from Chena Ridge. A couple of things I wanted to mention. I wanted to make a reference to a fantastic little bit that was on All Things Considered tonight about a man who had discovered for third world countries a perfect way of building. He said, of course, on the radio, we couldn't see it, but he said a combination of earth and water, and to build a fire on the inside of this structure, and in essence fire it and glaze the inside, and this was some kind of absolutely ready-made material. Every place in the world has fire and water and earth, and that it's a natural balance, and then it allows artistic expression in terms of you can carve and you can use different kinds of glazes, and it's antiseptic. And he described a sort of skid pad that you could do it on so that it would be earthquake proof. And I thought, well, it's got everything that Fairbanks needs except a good R factor. And so we were talking about...
Well, also, the less that we have in the soil here, it doesn't have a binder in it.
Is that right?
Yeah, and therefore it wouldn't fire.
We couldn't put something in like straw or...
We'd have to haul up some clay from Healy, is sort of not exactly your in-place construction.
Okay, I want to say that I enjoyed very much last week talking with Joan Kopanen and Larry Mayo about house building. I think that it's probably the subject for additional shows, because I would really like some other builders with other solutions to come on and talk about that. So if any of my listeners have suggestions. I did get a little bit in trouble this week because a friend of mine took exception with the fact that she thought I'd sort of derogatorily described houses with visqueen windows. No, I guess maybe a little hostility or negative something came out in my voice. I really think that if they're warm enough on the inside, it doesn't matter if there's visqueen. Chuck Dart out in Manly Springs, he built a visqueen house over the hot springs, and he says that he was going to build something a little more substantial, but the visqueen worked so well, he decided why bother. So actually, if you've got sufficient heat inside, there's nothing wrong with visqueen. So what I would like to, and one more thing I want to mention. When I come back, I'm going on vacation for 3 weeks, and when I come back, I was thinking about what I could do in preparation for Christmas, and I really need the audience's help, so I'm going to talk about this a little bit now. I think on December 20th, I'd like to talk about sort of traditional ways of celebrating Christmas in Fairbanks. This will be I did spend another Christmas there, but Sam was sick, and so it wasn't really very celebratory. So I would like some help from my audience on traditional ways to celebrate Christmas. And so those of you who live in cabins, I'd like the letters to start pouring in here talking about your favorite recipes or the things that you like to do. Because do you think the 20th is safe? All the people who are going to Hawaii will be gone by then. And so we'll have that much out of the way. And just the people who are in Fairbanks will be here to listen to that show and talk about ways to celebrate Christmas. So if you will help me and write your suggestions, I would appreciate that. Okay, I'm not going to limit the discussion to the topic that we're going to start out with, but last week we talked about the ways that traditional methods of building and the fact that people are building their own homes still continues in Fairbanks, but I'd like to start out tonight talking about how the original, not original, of course not original, but how much settling had to be done in a not too distant past. In other words, people who just arrived in Fairbanks 20 years ago remember vast areas of Farmers Loop being totally unsettled and so on. And so as much as we have preserved some of the older traditions, we've also changed tremendously in quite a short time. I have two fairly young men here with me, and they claim to remember the...
Thanks for the pottery.
Would you like either one of you to start off and talk about the ridge as you...
Well, Chena Ridge in the early 50s had been a very unsettled place. Part of the reason it was withdrawn because the airport was being planned up there, and they surveyed the ridge to see whether they could land the planes up there out of the ice fog, and they were doing that in the late 40s, 1950-51. And then they came to the dome at the far end of the ridge, Pyramid Dome, and couldn't figure out what to do with all that rock, and so they decided to put the airport down where they did put it. And then they opened it up in the summer of 52. Some people had filed on the property before, and some people, like Dave Dittman, had moved up there. Well, I shouldn't say some people. Dave Dittman, period, had moved up there during the war, because his original homestead was on what's now Ladd Air Force Base, and when the Army took that over to build the Army Air Force Base, he was given an option for another 160 acres, and he took his cat, his pickup truck, and his wife, and his sawmill, and all down the old railroad grade to the old Chena town site, and in along the river there, and that's how when Dave Dittman moved in. But essentially nobody moved in after him. There were some people who filed on property up there when they heard the airport was going in, but only one of them, who's a student at the university, Howard Bowman, lived there for any length of the time, and none of them proved up.
What did you have to do to file? What was required at that time?
Well, there was a Bureau of Land Management office in Fairbanks, and they had these old charts, and you'd look up to see which claims had been filed on property and how old they were, and if they had lapsed, you could file over them, and that was the situation up there. And we looked at property out Chena Hot Springs Road and other areas, but we wanted to get a view to the south slope. We'd spent one winter in the flats in college, and that was enough to decide we wanted to be up on a hill and towards south slope. And we filed on the property in 1952, and went up to look it over, and finally moved a Wanigan, built a Wanigan up there in March of 53, having spent the winter down in college. And there was the road that had been pushed in by the surveyors, and then there was the trails that had been cut by the mining company, by the FE company, Fairbanks Exploration Company, to serve the ditches that took the water from the Chena River via the Chena pump station up around to Cripple Sublevel, Esther Creek, Gold Hill. And
the pump station was in operation then?
Oh, yeah. The pump station remained in operation until about 1960, wasn't it? 62, wasn't it?
Yeah, just when I arrived up here, Neil, they closed the pump station down. Mm-hmm.
And when did you go up in, on the ridge? What?
I came into Alaska in 59, and then went straight up there. So. I knew of somebody who was living up there, and I went and made myself known to him, and he said, welcome me with open hands. And I pitched my tent in his yard, and stayed there till the winter. Then moved into a cabin further up the Chena Ridge and decided that I kind of liked the lifestyle up there.
Uh-huh. And, so in other words, Nilo and Joan filed on the land in 52, and there was still land available for filing in 59, or?
I think I was the last one to file up there, actually, because with the advent of statehood, and the withdrawals by the state of all the lands, the only land that was left available was land that was already filed on. And as the person that was homesteading that land, if they didn't live up to the requirements, the state took the land off them. Well, I was kind of fortunate because somebody that was about to have their homestead taken by the state relinquished it to me.
Okay.
And
lucky you.
They met me on the road, and they said, "Hey, you need 40 acres." I said, "God," I said, "I've been searching everywhere for a little land up here. So I'll go over and see so and so. The state's going to take his land next week or the week after, and he's ready to relinquish." So I went over and saw him, and he relinquished to me.
Okay, at that time, Austin, what did you have to do to prove up? Is that the expression, prove up?
Well, you had to build a habitable dwelling within a period of 12 months. Live on the land for a period of, I believe it was 6 months out of the year. Then the following year, 7 months out of the year. Then the following year, you had to clear 16...
It was 1/8 of the total acres.
1/16, I thought.
1/16 the first year.
And then the following year, another 1/16. Then you could apply for patent. Or you could go the way I went, which was a kind of a short way. I kind of cut a few corners. And you could live on the land a lot longer, like 15 months out of the first 2 years, and build a habitable dwelling and clear 1/16 within the 2 years. It was that living on the land that commuted it. And I moved up and lived on the land straight away. So I got that commuted, a 2 year period.
What kind of dwelling did you put up?
I just moved the old trailer house in at the time, and that sufficed me. It jacked it up and put a little insulation under it, it seemed to qualify as a habitable dwelling.
I've been amused. Sam
not
has
for
some,
final proof.
Not for final proof. Sam, right. Sam has some stories about some so-called habitable dwellings up there. I think when.
Well, I know one friend of mine out on above Yankovich Road who built a house, and it was 12 feet by 16 feet and had one window and one door. But when they came out to check it out, he was living in there with his horse and there was no floor. And he was most highly insulted because they turned him down. So he had to push out the horse and put in a floor, and that was. But we, other people could commute their time if they had military service, you know, 1 year for 1 year. And at first, they didn't have to do any land clearing, but finally they changed the regulation so that Austin got off easier than we did. But people who had been on the GI Bill had to clear land, whereas when we filed 7 years earlier, the old 1860 regulations were still in force, and if you had a military claim, you didn't have to clear land, but you did have to reside on it and file on it. What we did, we had to live on it at that time and clear 1/8 of it and farm it, and we built a habitable house that's still in the process of accumulation as well.
Building.
So talking about that reminds me of that housewarming party that I wasn't here at the particular time, but apparently Larry Braden homesteaded 80 acres up there. He just built the house and had a housewarming party, and the house and Nilo might have been at the party, I'm not too sure.
Right. Yeah.
Were you?
Yeah.
Is that why you got involved with the fire department? Is that
There were several students from the university there, and he took some of them down, to the campus. And one of the students had been smoking cigarettes, Larry had gotten an overstuffed sofa, one of these real hideous things, very lumpy because it had been thrown out someplace. And apparently the cigarette went down behind the mattress,
upholstery.
The upholstery, and when Larry was driving people down, it caught on fire. The next thing I knew that Joe and I were awakened by this pounding on the door. Nilo, come cook the house for me. So we all hauled water in those days from Fox Spring or something like that. So I took two buckets of water and very rushed up there carrying the water, and then I very carefully set the buckets down so as not to spill it, because it's quite obvious that we weren't going to do anything about it. And I eventually bought the property from Ben Zeller, who was a successor to Larry on that piece of property, because my driveway went through it. And then I gave an acre of that property, including the site of the burned dwelling, to the fire department. So the Chena Ridge Fire Station is on the site of the first dwelling to have burned down after the Second World War.
Very symbolically fitting.
Right. I always felt that was a good location for a fire station.
That was discouraging enough for Larry when house burned down at the housewarming. He just Lost heart. Yes,
actually,
took
he
off.
Filed in another 80 out in Chena Hot Springs, and he did prove up on part of that. But he got involved with the community action program in Fairbanks, and then statewide, and moved to Anchorage, and became a reporter, married a Russian girl, Rosita, who started Rosita's store up here. And, I guess he's still going around doing some photography, but I haven't seen him for years.
So anyway, he did fine, but he didn't flee the state anyway. That wasn't enough to turn him off totally. Just went from the ridge to Hot Springs.
He wasn't, none of us were really carpenters except Austin, but he was less.
That was kind of fortunate for me, because when I arrived on the ridge, everybody's building their own, all these homesteaders up and down building, and nobody really knew what was happening, so as soon as the word got out, I was a carpenter. I was just invited to everybody's house for dinner.
Of course.
And out came the blueprints. And what do we do about this? And are you doing anything on Saturday? And
well,
that particular
money.
Time, I wasn't doing anything. We were all on strike anyway in '59. Uh-huh. And so I used to go home and help everybody out.
That's really my guess. My audience is probably angry with me. I've chastised them for 6 weeks to please phone, and tonight I'm so fascinated I didn't even give them the phone number. Here it is. And they're probably all out there just chomping at the bit. 474-5044. If you would like to talk to Nilo and Austin, I encourage you to call. 474-5044. Maybe someone on the ridge is listening and they would like to call in and dispute some of these stories. They have maybe another version.
Might be. Think that they might come up with even more.
Okay, you Ridge dwellers, 474-5044, Chena Ridge. How many people do you think were living out on Chena Ridge at that time?
Well, at one point, 50s. I don't remember exactly. Toward the later 50s, we counted 28 families who drove up on the ridge road. In fact, we got to know all of them because the original road, which had been sort of bulldozed in to serve the mining company, had a couple of wiggles on it, and everybody managed to get stuck in front of our place, you know, in the wintertime. They'd come in for a cup of tea, I'd get the tractor, and I'd pull them out, and then we would go out someplace else and get stuck and go in for a cup of tea. So it was a one-lane road for a number of years, and quite an interesting piece of highway. I think nowadays it would be it's used by four-wheel drive. People as a test of skill and courage, the old road.
And what was your excuse? You didn't know better.
There was about 28 families up there. We dropped 40 acres and the Borchardt, whom we knew from the flats, piled on that, and then the Barnett. There had been Harold Penman, who homesteaded next to us and eventually left the state and went to Atlantic City to sell Kewpie dolls, and Dewey Smith and his wife, who worked on the base. I guess he was the base engineer at LAD. And Frank and Lena Dewey. And
of course, Mary Ann.
Came
Mary
Ann.
There.
Ted
and
Kegler.
Then the Harmons came just before I got in there. They were up there.
And Ben Zeller.
And Ev Lipscomb and Frank Dewey.
And Schlegel.
And the first well was hit up there by...
Gilbert? You mean Hugh?
Further around.
The first dry hole was Hugh Gilbert.
Yeah.
How far did he have to go? Was
to dig a dry hole?
Mm-hmm.
No, you can keep going a long way. I think Thibodeau punched it down about 350 feet before it lost the tools down there. But in that area, in our area, it's about 190 feet to water.
Do most people up on the ridge now have wells, or is it uneven?
Somewhat. But even at that depth, there isn't that much water. You know, you have to have a storage supply or something.
And sort of going down as use increases, is that a water table or?
That's an impervious layer of limestone. If you go through that, you lose the water.
Okay. So it's really critical to stop at the right.
Nobody ever thought there'd be any water up there until Ev Lipscomb punched a well down and he hit water. He was the second. The further off, Miner was the first. Yeah. Miner hit water.
Miner Spellhawk.
Yeah, but Miner went a tremendous distance.
600.
It was that far? Quite that much. But Miner went a long way. And then Ev was the first one to get it in at reasonable depth.
Because at Herb's place, at the bend of the road at about, 6 miles, 6.5 miles, there was a spring, which would glacier out over the road. And there was a spring across from us on the north side of the hill that the people from the mining company used to come up and get water. But just because there was a spring there didn't mean that the water came up any reasonable routing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, audience, 474-5044. I've heard a lot of references to sort of Chena Ridge people. There seemed to be a particular sense of community up there and camaraderie. Did you have that sense?
Decades of pulling each other out of the ditch.
It was the mud. It was the snow. It was the ice. What kind of vehicles did you have to get up that goat trail?
Well, and before the roads were improved, almost everybody had four-wheel drive. Of course, the Keglers had a collection of vehicles, which not all of which were four-wheel drive at that time.
I think all the homesteaders up there always had at least four or five wrecks in the yard, just because the hadn't made it through the
ancillary vehicle. Yes.
That's what we call them, ancillary.
One winter when everyone's vehicle had wouldn't run except Hugh Gilbert, who was a lawyer in town at the time, Marianne Kegler would go around in this old Studebaker pickup with no heater and no side windows, and she ran what was called the Chena Ridge Vapid Transit. And pick up everybody who was bound for campus, and we'd go down there all bundled up. Hugh Gilbert and his wife, actually, they had a Buick.
A Buick?
A Buick, yes. I remember one time they got stuck on the hill, and I was going to, and Hugh asked for help, and I suggested that his wife sit in the back seat because she was... Well, anyway, it gave enough traction that they went easily enough that time.
A Buick. Amazing.
I remember one time when I had a Volkswagen Bug, this was somewhat later, the snow was so heavy that it was sliding on top. So I pulled out the hand throttle and pushed the little thing uphill by myself until we got it through the snow because they were so skittish. And then there was the time that they had the maneuvers. The Army was always having winter maneuvers, and a tank battalion got lost, and they went all the way around in a ridge of heavy snow. And so you had the tank treads treading and chewing up the road, and it was utterly impassable. And Frank Dewey called up the commandant as a Marine, saying, "The Army doesn't know." Frank is an ex-Marine, and he chewed out. Come on down on land. And they came up and they scraped and polished and made the thing all nice again.
Better than before.
Better than before.
How did they get lost on Chena Ridge?
Well, they weren't headed on Chena Ridge. They were headed for Nenana. But they had the National Guardsmen from some other state. They bring people in for the maneuvers from other areas. And the young fellow who was in charge of that tank column, charge. Only he went left instead of right, and there were some problems. He was supposed to be on the other side of the river heading for Nenana, and somehow he had on this side of the river going around the ridge.
What can we say? These things happen.
Details.
Little details. Well, do you garden? Do you get good gardening up on the ridge? Is that one of those areas where the soil does not yield? Speaking of homesteading, I always think of homesteading as farming. I, in fact, know that you do some farming or have attempted to do some farming. Is it you have a nice exposure up there?
Right, southern exposure, and then the area that we cleared for a garden has been there for 30 years. And we've used it for many years as also as the corral in the wintertime. We used to feed the horses hay there, so that kept us from hauling fertilizer in, and have worked it. So it's quite rich for the garden, and also quite weedy for that same mm-hmm. reason. And the less does grow rather good crops of grass in our pastures and our hay fields. The main problem, one of the problems is, of course, in cold, wet summers, you begin to get moss developing in the lower portions, which indication of acid soil, cold acid soil. So we have to lime the hay field, but that's not the only place in the world where we have to do that. Mm-hmm. I guess Kentucky is about the only place you don't have to do
don't
that.
Don't have to do that. Okay, we have a caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? You can talk now. Don't hear our caller. Looks like the caller's still on. Anyway. Okay, we'll just keep going. Maybe they went to get a sandwich. Okay. There's a lot of things you have to do to the soil around this area, and you can compensate. I was interested when I was working with John Holm. He said that not too long ago, that whole area called Farmer's Loop was in fact potato farms and supplied a good amount of the potato and cabbage crop for, I guess, the central interior.
And carrots. Elbert had a lot of carrots there, I remember.
How long ago was that? Do you remember chronologically in terms of the homesteading of the ridge?
Well, it was about the same time, the latter part, in the late 50s, early 60s. I think a lot of problems arose with farming in this area in the early mid-60s. The market devolved from outside, importation of a lot of things. And also putting capital in the wrong things. At one point we had Carnation, Creamers, Golden Heart, and Shaw Creek Dairies. You had four dairies operating, and you had maybe 250 cows. Now 250 cows would feed the production line of one dairy for about half a day. They put the equivalent amount of money into more cows, more acres, mm-hmm. dairies might have survived.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our caller is back, or another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. I don't know, I guess, dear callers, there's something wrong with our phones. They're going to work on it now. Did you do any farming, Austin? Did you?
I did just the required farming. The particular 40 acres I got is awful steep. Really, it's really not homesteading land at all. Not in the farming sense of it. It's just a little too steep to do much with. I have a nice little garden, but
it's an animals for the children too.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's
have animals. Time.
Excuse me. Let's see if we can get our caller. Hello. You're on the air. No. Should be. No. Hello. No, it's nothing in here. It's just
the miracles of modern science.
You know,
reminds me of the telephone system we had on the ridge. We had two lines. They didn't connect with each other, but we had two lines. We had four army phones between four different homesteads. We never did get the two lines connected, though. We didn't have enough wire.
Okay, now it's good. Hello, you're on the air.
Am I?
Yes, you are.
Oh, well, good.
I'm glad, too.
A little problem there.
Welcome.
I would like to ask the two gentlemen, if the kind of homestead they did, something really kind of like speculation.
Hmm?
Speculation.
Well, I think that certainly the GI time homes rule under homesteading was quite speculative, because there wasn't a requirement in the beginning for any sweat equity, as Austin says later, there was. But the old 1860 Homestead Act, under which we homesteaded, had this requirement for residents on the property up to 5 years, and...
Well, that's not quite true.
What do you mean?
Well,
it certainly was true in my day.
Well,
I didn't get any easier. Well, a lot of people did speculate, but it wasn't necessary.
It's quite true that you could pay for the land $1.25 an acre after 6 months residence, or after holding it for 6 months and then sell the land.
No, you didn't have title for that. You had to pay a final prove-up fee, but it was... unless you were an XGI, in which case you could do it at the end of 1 year.
At the end of 1 year, then you could at least... wasn't it kind of speculative, though?
Hmm?
Wasn't it kind of speculative?
Well, it's less speculative than some of the giveaway land proposals we have today, because of the requirement of building the and residing on the property and clearing and cultivating it. I wouldn't have been eligible for PRUVIP on, except for 3 years, because I didn't have military time, and actually, as a matter of fact, it took us 5 years to file on it. Certainly there was a great deal of speculation. I'm not saying that. I don't really approve of a particular kind of homesteading thing that does not require sweat equity, that is the putting in of time and energy and dedication to the land.
Well, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Because the homestead laws that were used were highly speculative.
It's a matter of opinion. I think the current laws are much more speculative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Hello,
I'm sorry. Okay.
Let me just take this caller so they don't have to hang on. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't mind hearing about the same subject you were just talking about. In fact, I'm very interested in it. But earlier you asked about the old Kinneridge community feeling, and I was raised on the ridge. I'm the old daughter, in fact. And I certainly had that feeling when I was a child. And I think the paving of the ridge, which mostly, well, to a large extent, it paved the way for a lot more development and people, also ended up taking away the necessity of dragging each other out of the ditches. Higher standards of living brought us so that not all the neighbors would stop in at one particular house to get water or use the phone and things like that. But another thing that I would like to hear, if Austin and Nilo could at least quote, if not sing, any of the renditions of the songs to be sung in case of emergency, and perhaps comment on that.
I think that if we tried to sing, we would create an emergency.
Oh, not necessarily. Songs to be sung in case of emergency. This is very interesting.
Yeah, well, I've
got to
hang up.
Okay, I'll work on this. Thank you. I do want to give you a chance to address the first gentleman. We'll get back to the songs of emergency. In reference to the notion that it's land speculation.
It's just my feeling that the atmosphere and the environs and the conditions were so severe for homesteaders. That ridge road was so rough, and there were no electric heaters for the car. Winter was, and to live on the land for five or 6 months and build a habitable dwelling, it was quite a difficult process. And lots of people didn't make it. I mean, I went out in Chino Hot Springs quite a few times, saw those people there. They drive in, they drive out. They'd have to no work in the winter, drive into town, drive out. It was really a hard life for those people. I had it, it was comparatively easy when I came. The road was beat through, and it wasn't that one track. It was two lane. Of course, it was still rough, but there was a little more work around. Yeah, but I don't think anybody that went out there to homestead went out there with the idea that here, 10 years down the line, down the pike here, this is really going to be worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I never thought it would be worth anything.
Right.
I never thought they were going to discover oil on the North Slope, and that land up on the Chin Ridge was just going to go out of sight, and land values everywhere are going to go out of sight. We just didn't think it was ever going to happen.
Well, I really think proof of that is the fact that there are a lot of people who have been in Fairbanks 40, 50 years, and I know that Sam says he was offered land out in Farmers Loop not in 1950, mm-hmm. but sometime considerably after that, at 100, mm-hmm. 200 an acre, and he thought, well, what's the point of that? I mean, aside from the fact that he didn't have any money, it just seemed too far out and too much trouble. And he said, of course, I'm not, you know, obviously I don't have some idea of what's going to be good in the future, but I think there are a lot of Fairbanksans who had a lot of options to pick up land, mm-hmm. and it seemed as remote as some of these so-called remote packages.
That were available about two or three years ago. I think there was talk about flying in and people were jumping out of parachutes and fire. Well, maybe they'll discover gold in that area, and in 5 years, that particular parcel might be worth a fortune, and then somebody will come along and say, well, I mean, just speculate. I don't think there's been as much money made by the people at home set it up here as by the real estate brokers and the people that came in after and speculated on it, bought it and resold it. And that's my own feelings.
Well, call it Chena Hill subdivision was John Penman's homestead, and John sold that when he went outside in the late 60s, early 70s, late 60s, I guess, mid-60s. For about for $6,000, 160 acres, and let's see, Larry. No, I mean Ben Zeller sold his 120 for, I believe, 17,000. Most of
very very cheap.
17,000,
yeah. And then, who are those people above next to Irv over there? They sold theirs for 6,000, 80 acres.
Right.
They just couldn't take it anymore. People's families used to fall apart. I mean,
land speculation, but it was not the people who lived on the land. It was the people who came in afterwards, and this is one of the reasons for some people considering real estate speculators got a sort of vultures because they circle around waiting for you to give up and leave. I'm not sure that they really.
I think that's one of those broad spectrum things. I think they're the absentee land speculators in any situation, whether you're talking about Florida swampland or Arizona desert, that never even show up, and then there's everything in between, and then down to someone who innocently lucks in or by a series of mishaps ends up with something that ultimately becomes quite valuable and not through more luck than design. And I suppose we've got everything in between in Fairbanks.
I think
just on the ridge, but
in terms of time, just by the end of a week or a month or something like that, we were the first batch, the first group to homestead up there. But I remember people saying, what on earth do you want to move so far out of town for? It's all this nice land. And, well, I want to get far enough out of town to see the mountains and not be part of it. And it was considered the wilderness in those days.
But you didn't have electricity and the thing of keeping vehicles going and getting materials in.
Let's see, the road went out past the university and then at the experiment station, there's a little road across the railroad track. Then it tied on to the old narrow gauge railroad grade when there were still the railroad ties in it from the day they torn it up and 20 years before or something like that. And then there was the mining trails up the hill, and that was all there was in access.
Okay, we have another caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, I suppose on behalf of people like Nilo and Austin, who used to be my neighbors, I'm a little offended at somebody who perhaps a late arrival who assumes that people buy land for speculation, and I have to confirm the fact that when one of our immediate neighbors, and I was residing in the Zeller house at the time, felt guilty about wanting to sell off his land, but he was old and he was sick, and he felt very guilty about asking $200 an acre. Nobody had $200. $3,000 a year for a family was, you're pretty fat. You can go to the movie. you can buy real food, you can buy real beer, you don't have to make it your own. But there was, as Austin said, the terrible toll on families, the children, you work, you go to school, and that the whole business now, the option seems to be, well, how quick can I prove it up and resell it for 100 times its original sale price?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really rather glad that you've got two good old friends of mine. Thank you both very much.
Me too. Actually, I think this sort of what's difficult is relative. As a relative newcomer myself, I think that getting through a Fairbanks winter with everything running fairly steadily is a bit of a task. I mean, certainly compared to other places I've lived, and I don't trudge off through the woods, although I love the part in Joan's book where your daughter says that she thinks everyone should be a quarter of a mile from the road because they get to see the winter and they get to see the stars. And it's a sort of, you need incentive to stay out in it sometimes when it's really cold. And I think we all feel a little bit better as a consequence for it, but I mean, I do think it's relative, and it's amazing to me reading some of the old mining stories without the modern equipment, without the without the rescue squads and people knowing to look for you. They covered some amazing terrain in really terrible conditions.
Well, actually, I think the old-timers who came before us certainly covered turned over every rock in Alaska, I think, looking for something, thinking of the songs to be sung in case of emergency in the automobiles. Those were songs written by Marianne Kegler and others, collected by Marianne. They were University of Alaska songs, the student songs, and homesteader songs. But one whole chapter is devoted to automobiles. And I remember one version of the Banana Boat song, you know, Deo, Chino Ridge is a hell of a road. 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot ditch, Deo, daylight come and I want to go home.
And that was on a day there were only 4 hours of daylight, right?
But it was important enough to occupy a whole chapter in the song.
There were lots of songs that were written by Marianne dealing with the condition of the road. One was about the grader who was going to go and muck up the Chino Ridge Road and knocked off at 10 for coffee with 10 homesteaders right behind him wanting to get past. And then there was another one about that car of Ted's. The thing about songs and about language is that it reflects the importance of these things in your life. And if those songs are anything to go by, the traveling the road was
that was a significant part of your day.
It certainly was.
You're on the air.
Yes. I just happened to be driving along and heard some people talking about hard work and being here because we love this land. And in the days when a living was hard-earned, and I'd just like to carry it a little bit further by saying that there's going to be a time when that's just going to be hard to come by again after all this big money's gone, and that people that love this land will still be here, our children and their children will be here, and that we should right now take advantage of the fact that we have a boon right now. It's called the royalty oil money, and it rightly belongs to the people that will be here after all this is over. And I don't mean in the form of handouts, I don't believe in that. What I mean is to be available for our usage, to further the endless sources of energy that we have here, such as the hot springs, the wind power that blows up and down the rivers, and numerous other forms of energy that we could tap into, you know. It's just so much potential. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Austin, I would like to say that the icebergs will come and reach too.
Icebergs. Yes.
And the bars. There's a lot of people out there who can see Alaska like a child holding a big diamond right now in their hands, and there's a whole lot of people who are practiced to be out of taking candy from babies, so to speak. And right now it's time for people to start sign petitions and get that working on money in a bank in Alaska and in California. I just like to say, I really feel strongly, and I think that this ties into what these people are really super coming.
Okay, thank you.
The thing is, we have to make that advantage work for us. Otherwise, we may as well be fools.
Thank you, caller. I think it's, of course, always a question of how to do that. I mean, I think a lot of people want that. It's just a question of how to use those resources to the best advantage for everyone, and that's probably the continuing debate, and we'll be talking about that for some time to come. At some point, I really do want to do a show on the sort of solar, and again, a little more detail about that we touched on briefly last time about water collection and so on, because I think there are some ingenious solutions in that way in this state, and those solutions have been most effective in terms of private dwellings. That those energy sources have not been, those kinds of passive energy sources have not proved to be real easy to translate into industrial power, but certainly part of the solution, and something that I think of Fairbanks since have used with great imagination. Of course, solar has its limitations here.
It's interesting, you know, this goes up and down, because we had, Joan and I had friends in Ohio that were very interested in these kinds of things 30, 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when we built the barn, that skylight was intended to be the mounting for a solar heating. And when we put that in, and that one was the 59 when you helped us.
That's right, yeah.
They that year before, they had stopped manufacturing the old solar heating units that had been so popular before. Before you couldn't get one. And so, you know, we have a whole gap of 20 years when we suddenly we rediscovered this technology that was there all the time.
Mm-hmm. So it was, in fact, something that was being used in the late 40s, early 50s?
Oh, yeah, and before that, actually. Some of the old pictures you see of California and Arizona, you see these units on the roof. You know, they were not air conditioning units in those days. Those were the hot water heating units for most of the places in that part of the country were heated, both hot water and domestic heat, by solar units which were manufactured by two or three firms in those days.
Hmm.
And they stopped using it when cheap natural gas came in and other things were, quote, more convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Everything like that.
Seemed to be somewhat short-sighted. I know in the Midwest and in the Southwest, windmills were very popular, especially for bringing water up for mm-hmm. cattle and so on. And needed very, very little maintenance. Mm-hmm. And those just all went out of use and stopped being regularly maintained just not too much before the energy shortage occurred. In
Fairbanks Creek, the dredgemaster's house had a wind charger with batteries in the attic. They had just disconnected the batteries and started using line power at that time. I remember Live and Good when I first went up there. There were still several old wind chargers around to provide electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was, again, in the 50s, and people stopped using it.
Well, it seemed easy, I guess, at the time. Right?
Maybe the
right.
wind didn't blow often enough.
Right.
Quite maybe a little unreliable.
Well, that,
I
mean, obviously.
I ran out of batteries.
Obviously, those are the reasons that we embrace technology, because it is easier. I mean, it's fine when you turn the switch on and there's light and there's heat. Now, it's very annoying to be in one of those houses when those things are failing and you are left to, you really can't do anything. Mm-hmm. Everything stops. The water doesn't come out of the ground. The heat doesn't happen. It can be quite dangerous. But
they drilled a deep hole out at Eielson Air Force Base here. What was that, about 10 years ago? They were drilling this hole. They were supposed to be going down 3 or 4 miles for some reason or other. Remember that? Maybe they were trying to get a little source of heat from out of there, though I kind of doubt it. But
an experimental, and we never did hear the results of the experiment. So
military,
I guess.
What, on the Greenland notion that we have geothermal something?
Well, we do have geothermal. It may be that they did not choose one of the better places, but I don't know enough about it other than that they did drill that experimental hole there.
If we have a listener out there who knows a little bit more about that project, 474-5044. Okay, back to Mary Ann. You had a piano up on the ridge where she did her composing. Did she play?
Mary Ann seemed to be able to play every instrument that was going around, banjo, guitar.
Accordion,
piano. I recall one particular party that we were at there where she started playing this polka and Nilo started to polka. And she just wouldn't stop. And it was just a battle between whether Nilo was going to collapse first or she was going to collapse first.
Who did?
I think they called it a draw.
Yeah, she said they used to just, everyone would just haul the kids and sort of let them fall asleep where they would, and you would just, well, I guess it was such an effort, first of all, to get together. You probably, did you do it frequently, or?
Well, in the winter it was more frequent because, you know, there weren't so many other things to do. In the summertime, you're always, you'd had a job, and then you'd come home and you'd work another 8 hours in the house, and land clearing, or whatever else, and there would be special times for a party. I remember the first, when the snow started to go, and the first blade of grass was seen, we had a grassy banks party. And then when the water left, break up for a few years, there was a regatta.
the Cripple regatta.
Creek Chowder and Purlieu Society regatta, which usually featured homemade craft of various designs. They would be schooners big enough for one person, you know, that kind of thing, in the gravel pit. Or for a while there, we would have a New Year's party, which was the Royal Military Review and Ball in honor of Her Royal Highness H.R.A., the Grand Duchess Anastasia, who, after all, you know, would have been the descendant of the Tsar and therefore the Grand Duchess.
Oh, I see. This was a Russian holiday.
Well, you know, after it was that, whatever.
Well, I mean, we really had to dig deep for good ideas for parties. I mean, we didn't have a party to think of reasons for parties.
That's right. Need to consider the theme.
right. Yeah, they all had something that I remember when Sparky Jewett flunked out of ROTC on the U of A here, and we had...
Flunked out of ROTC?
Well, yes. He came up for a dress review with wearing sneakers and some other irregular things, and that was enough for the colonel. But we had a review and a ball, and we awarded him a ribbon and a medal, which had been cut... Royal Order of the Gold Brick.
High on irreverence up on the ridge.
Life was serious enough, you know. We might as well take some things with a, shall we say, a grain of salt.
Well, I think community is really important in those kind of situations. I mean, there was a lot of hard work, and there were some situations that were less than pleasant. I mean, it's sort of easy to laugh about the cars in the ditch now, but when you deal with that on a fairly steady basis, I don't imagine it was all that amusing some evenings.
Not at all.
Some of those switchbacks going up the Chino Ridge were pretty severe, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And that first snow of the year is bad on Chino Ridge now, but that first snow there, you'd speed up to get around that first hairpin, and you'd belt round. You'd be doing all of 25 miles an hour getting around there, and there was somebody right across the road, and right in front of him was somebody else, and in front of him was somebody else, because once you hit those brakes to stop, you're just straight in.
What'd you do about car insurance? Were all your
car insurance?
Car insurance.
Come on now. A, you couldn't insure those things. B, you couldn't afford the insurance. I remember one time in the summer, you know, it's been raining and that lust gets nice and slimy, and charging up the double switchback there and finding myself with all four wheels grinding forward, sliding backward down the hill, and totally ignominious feeling. I mean, the great big four-wheel drive, forget it. There was that. Actually, one of the things, someone once wrote about homesteading, and said that you bet 5 years of your life against 160 acres of Uncle Sam's property. And it was also suggested that was Uncle Sam's solution to agricultural overproduction. You know, take all these feisty young farmers and people, you know, out of the areas where they can do some agriculture and set them off where obviously all they're going to do is spin their wheels for a while.
Austin on the side of a slope with no chance to... Well, they didn't really expect to farm up there. It's more.
Well, actually, the Homestead Act was intended
for
settling the country, and that was the reason it was passed in 1860. It was an alternative to giving away large acreages to plantation development or real estate sales, which had been the habit prior to that.
Mm-hmm. When I traveled up the highway in 59 to Alaska, I had never heard of homesteading at that particular time. But the people I met coming up, all with their families, trailers, horses, everything, were all heading up. It seemed like the highway was just full of people coming up from Montana mostly, it seemed like, and Idaho, those two states, and the Dakotas as well. They'd heard about it, and they were heading up to get into the homesteading. They're mostly heading down to Kenai. I don't think I bumped into anybody coming up to Fairbanks. I think they must have been pretty serious about it.
Yeah. They wanted to last. They wanted to succeed.
But the highway was just full of them coming up.
Well, that's obviously always been an incentive. My grandparents were working as hired people after they came from Sweden and Norway to Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and they heard in the newspaper a homesteading ad in the Alberta, north of Edmonton area, actually land that is right adjoining the Alcan Highway near San Gudo, and that's what they did. They had to clear the land. Eventually, they cleared it all, but they wouldn't have had enough money at that time to purchase land. That was their only way of sort of beginning.
When I grew up, in New York City, and I was we went to the Finn Hall. My mother acted in the plays there, and most of the plays had to do with peasant life on the farm in the backwoods in Finland. And it was, you know, when I went over to Finland in 1948 with the French Service Committee helping refugees clear land, it was exactly the same sort of thing. So it was sort of, that's, you know, it was just it's a tradition, like you say, from Norway, Sweden, Finland, any place like that. Get yourself certain number of acres and just work yourself to the bone,
right?
For that piece of land and for your family, of course. That was an important part of it.
Well, especially coming out of the European tradition where there was so little land and been divided and divided and divided, was one of the real incentives for the kind of sacrifice, leaving your home and family in Europe, not just Northern Europe, other places, and making that sacrifice to come and get.
Oh yeah, the Borchards, for example, who were from Germany, they were very oriented toward settling land, same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. It was certainly a new experience for me, coming up and just being thrust into all these people, all these homesteaders. It really opened my eyes and changed my whole outlook on things. I suddenly, from wandering around, wondering what I wanted, I suddenly knew what I wanted. I wanted a little of this action. I wanted to get some land. I wanted to go through all this stuff. And,
hardship.
it didn't look like hardship. Okay. Yeah, it didn't look like hardship.
Where had you lived before?
I came from England, and I came into Canada, 57, and then met some people that knew some people that knew some people that knew of a person who was living up here, and heard some tales and thought, "My, that sounds like a good place to go." There's not much going on here. I was in Toronto, in Canada.
But you didn't have an agrarian background either?
No agrarian background, no.
Just start from scratch, you'd met the people on the ridge. And from New York, obviously, you weren't raised with dirt beneath your fingernails, Nilo.
Well, when I was much younger, I lived on my uncle's farm in upstate New York. And then during the war, we had the land army, if you remember.
No, I don't.
I'm sorry. That's right. Yeah. Okay. High school kids went out to pick crops and things like that. So I did that for a couple of summers when I was about 14. It was the first time I really got away from home on my own. Got a railroad ticket, and my mother saw me off, and I picked crops so with a couple of other Finnish kids at that time.
Well, it was real clear talking to Joan and Larry last week, too, that although it's hard work, it's very gratifying. You have something very visible, and I haven't been to Austin's, but I know that Nilo's place is really nice and it's probably worth.
Austin's is much nicer. It actually
well, he's
like
the one with the skills, right? He's the one who's the contractor. Yeah, remember?
Not, but it's not finished. Remember that.
The only person on the ridge that could be a contractor. All right. It looks like the hour has passed. I'm going to be on vacation for a few weeks. I hope you'll tune in. One of the things you're going to hear is a dog mushing program with Sue Corte in my absence. Send in your recipes and your traditional Christmas suggestions. And when I return on December 13th, I'm going to be visiting with Mary Beth Smetzer and some women from the Cabin Fever Quilters. And I'm really looking forward to that. Our executive producer was Carla Tonella. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Have a very nice evening and keep your home fire burning.